Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, July 28th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and that will probably lead into the cover story. After that, Points of Progress is back, so I'll read that. But Science and Nature's AWOL, so I'll read the explainer. And then the Home Forum, which includes a recipe. And then the Monitor's View. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled Teamwork and Finding Ways to Buoy Spirits. This is written by Melanie Stetson Freeman, who happens to be a staff photographer. And you can email her at freemanm@csmonitor.com. And she writes, reporters often specialize in a certain type of coverage. News, politics, justice, features. Photojournalists usually do not. We shoot it all, from portraits to news, wildlife to culture. But reporters and photographers both gain entry to situations we would never experience and people we would never meet in different careers. It's thrilling. It's interesting. It's different every day. But this job can be challenging when we're faced with the difficult stuff. Writer Patrick Johnson lives in the southeast United States, and one of his beats is storm reporting. In this week's cover story, he focuses on his coverage of Hurricane Katrina, one of the most destructive storms in current memory. He tells how he and those affected wrestled with the impact. I joined him on multiple journeys to report on Katrina's aftermath. I remember when we first got to New Orleans 20 years ago, just a week after Katrina hit the city. Levees had failed, spilling water into neighborhoods filled with iconic homes. Floodwater flowed into our tall rubber boots as we navigated streets turned into rivers. Working late into the night, we'd arrive back at our lodging in Baton Rouge, more than an hour away, exhausted and melancholy. In those dire situations, people came together. That's the takeaway every time. The helpers, the pulling together of communities. We look for positives in order to not be dragged down ourselves. When we heard a woman was taking a boat to her waterlogged home to rescue her cat, we went along. The mission had a successful outcome not only for her feline, but also for a tiny kitten that I rescued after I found it cowering in a downed tree. It was a small victory that buoyed our spirits. Patrick and I have worked as a team many times. I enjoy working with him because he always finds wonderful characters to interview. No surprise, he's quite the character himself. Usually barefoot, even in gritty New Orleans, he prefers to sleep in his old and bedraggled van on a mattress in the back. He doesn't like his smartphone and prefers to wander rather than use GPS. That's often how the characters are found, by happenstance. Patrick's methods are a bit unusual, but we always get what we need. In the cover story, he looks back and relates how the city has rebounded with the help of the many characters who call it home. Oh, and that tiny kitten? I couldn't bring him home, but I heard he grew to be a big, healthy boy living with the cat rescuer's brother. And that was the From the Editor column this week, written by Melanie Stetson Freeman, who's a staff photographer. And it was entitled, Teamwork and Finding Ways to Buoy Spirits. And that does lead us into the cover story. It's entitled, Remembering Katrina 20 Years Later. After the most expensive natural disaster in U.S. history, New Orleans continues to build on its recovery through music and culture. This is written by Patrick Johnson, who is a staff writer. And they do have that paragraph here, entitled Why We Wrote This, and it's got a heading of Resilience. In 2005, Hurricane Katrina threatened to snuff out the spirit of New Orleans. Two decades later, our reporter chronicles the city's healing journey. From New Orleans and Waveland, Mississippi, when I drove into New Orleans 20 years ago, crossing the Huey P. Long Bridge just a few days after the levee broke, I gripped the steering wheel of my van, suddenly awash in a sense of dizzying unease. I was at the time a freelance stringer with a byline labeled Special to the Monitor. I happened to have a newborn at home and a head full of self-doubt, and at that moment I wasn't sure about the enormity of this particular assignment. It's different now as I head back to New Orleans ahead of the 20th anniversary of that historic storm, looking to chronicle the growth that has taken place since that disaster threatened to wash away the soul of this vibrant city. I'm following some of the paths I took when covering the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, remembering that time, those scenes. 20 years after that catastrophe, New Orleans' larger recovery has been a complicated story of progress, ongoing challenges, and missed opportunities. It was still a lawless city when I arrived in 2005. As dark descended and I settled into my van for the night, so did fear. Rumors abounded, most outrageous, but some not far from the truth about the human toll. About 1,800 people are believed to have perished during Katrina and its aftermath, most from the storm surge in Mississippi and catastrophic flooding in New Orleans. The most expensive natural disaster in U.S. history, United States history, it caused over $200 billion in damage. I didn't intend to be a storm writer, a reporter who embeds within natural disasters and writes about the communities they affect. I live in a hurricane-prone South, so proximity was part of how I got the gig. At the same time, it's true I'm naturally inclined to bare-bones living in remote places. Colleagues laugh about the various live-aboard vans I've guided through the gathering clouds and flooded bayous. I often prefer to stay in my van, even when I can expense a hotel. Monitor photographer and friend Melanie Stetson Freeman, who goes by Mel, has the same question every time she sees a new old van. Van, does it have a name? No, I always chuckle. There's a picture of me from that time, kneeling in a collared shirt, grinning ear to ear after I joined others in a salvaged skiff with an outboard motor. I was accompanying rescuers, looking for people and animals still stranded in the sunken parts of New Orleans. At one point, we pulled an older woman on board after she struggled to forge forward in chest-deep water towards safety. It's confusing in some ways to see that grin. I remember the emotional rush, but it takes a toll. That sense of unease I felt crossing the rusted span of the Huey P. Long Bridge seemed to become a recurring acquaintance. For a long time after that, every time I crossed a large bridge, I felt like I was going to tip over. Communities reemerge, but they reemerge differently. People search for what once was, a piece of flatware, a boat transom, a bent-up old .22 rifle, or an old guitar. They drag the past from the wreckage and use it to imagine the future. This year, I've brought my Guild A20 Dreadnought guitar, my road companion. I'm realizing that this reporting trip is also to build a connection across the decades, maybe one as rickety and rusty as that old Huey Long, and to see the effects on communities and people, including myself, and how they recover. These days, I take the low-to-the-water Interstate 10 bridge into New Orleans from Slidell. I'm driving the gray hulk of my 2008 Chevy Express, which is now surpassing 300,000 miles. But this time, I am staying in a rental, a shotgun-style short-term place near the Treme, the city's iconic music district. I go to a nearby coffee house the next morning where school kids in uniforms are already plinking away standards on a well-tuned upright piano. Wrens are cajoling amid the Magnolia Grandiflora. I sip chicory-infused coffee and chat with the shop owner about a day that's dawning with surprising coolness. Afterward, I find a great steep stoop from where I can less watch but rather consider the city. I grab my Guild and sit down, strum some cowboy chords in B major, and noodle some lines from my reporter's notebook. She's an angel, even when she's falling down. She's an angel in a wrong part of town. As I hum, children on their way to school walk by. One is carrying a tuba. A girl smiles at me and says, "Sounds good." Brian Belknap traded a guitar for a life in New Orleans. A Chicago native arrived a decade ago, well after the ravages of Katrina. Like so many before him, he fell for the languid city's slow charms. With little money, he lived on the streets for a while, busking for change. but then he traded his 1942 Martin D18 for a battered shotgun shack in St. Rock. This 1942 Martin acoustic model is known as the Elvis guitar. Elvis Presley's personal version sold for a record $1.32 million at auction in 2020. Every day, Mr. Belknap walks into the French Quarter in the early, cooler parts of the day, setting up the instruments that now make up his one-man swamp band on Royal Street. There's still desperation here, Mr. Belknap says, but out here, it's an intimate experience. The people are close. The music is everywhere. Even in hard times, the sense of joy is unmistakable. To punctuate that point, he grabs an accordion, gives a kick on a hi-hat pedal, and rolls into an original song about folks stomping the varnish off a dance floor. Though he's not a native, in some ways, Mr. Belknap's presence here is a small part of New Orleans' recovery. The city lost a third of its population after the hurricane, but it has been bouncing back, not through what it was before, though not to what it was before Katrina. There's a new $15 billion system of levees, floodgates, and drainage canals built to better withstand storms like Katrina. The public school system, among the worst in the country before 2005, has been revamped. Today, graduation rates have risen significantly, and more New Orleans high schoolers are going straight to college than before. But the city continues to grapple with the lasting impacts of the initial federally funded rebuilding plan called Road Home. Over $9 billion in federal funds was allocated for residents to rebuild, but within a tangle of Byzantine application procedures, disbursements too were based on property values before Katrina struck. This left mostly black, low-income residents with far less to rebuild, and long-standing racial disparities continue today. Katrina, in many ways, reshaped the way we think about vulnerability in disasters, says Jeanette Sutton, a sociologist who studies emergency preparedness at the State University of New York at Albany. Road Home and other programs, she says, have proved that if you were poor before a disaster, the disaster response is not going to improve your well-being. If you were barely getting by before, you're not going to be better off with the funding in the aftermath. But those who could afford a disaster are probably going to recover pretty well. Gentrification has also changed the flavor of New Orleans in many ways. The city continues to debate limiting short-term and highly profitable tourist rentals, like the one I'm staying in, which create a demand for housing and cause other rents to rise. The checkerboard of empty lots in the hard-hit Lower Ninth Ward, too, still defines many of the failures of the federal rebuilding plan. There's no handbook on how to navigate Hurricane Katrina or something devastating on that level, says Bill Taylor, executive director of the Trombone Shorty Foundation, which helps train young musicians and teach them about New Orleans musical history. But a lot of us figured, hey, there's a lot of work to do. It seemed like this culture that we all love is in jeopardy because the city went silent. What do we do to bring it back? His foundation has grown from an idea to a bridge organization, he says, using the traditions that came before Katrina to rebuild a city still leaning on its vibrant culture of art and vice, desperation and exhilaration. It's funny how these words came out of the Katrina experience. Culture keeper, culture bearer, Mr. Taylor says. Those are the people that make the city so special. That's why people fall in love with New Orleans, because of those who create and uphold the culture. The Indian chiefs, the brass band musicians, the funk and jazz musicians. Everybody in their own way tried to get back to be part of the rebuilding experience. Liz LaFrere was 8 years old, living in New Orleans East, when Katrina struck. She thought she'd miss a day or two of school. 4 months later, the family returned to live in the broken city, since her father was a police officer. 10 years ago, when she was a student at Tulane, the campus flooded on August 29th, the Katrina anniversary. Ms. LaFrere broke down in uncontrollable tears. "It came out of nowhere," she says. "It's definitely part of a communal trauma." Yet the storm's indelible impact also created a new life for her. Today, Ms. LaFrere is part of an artist collective dedicated to understanding Katrina and its aftermath through art, including massive portrait murals that now dot and define the city. Artists like Ms. LaFrere are committed to telling a tangibly redemptive story. The art is where expression can be a catalyst for change, she says. The murals help create a sense of people seeing themselves reflected in the face of the city. The narrative of New Orleans expanded. Mel and I are driving out of New Orleans towards Baton Rouge, sharing memories of a similar drive we took 20 years ago. Back then, we were hoping to land an interview with then-General Russell Honoré, who had gained fame as the no-nonsense leader of New Orleans recovery efforts. On this spring day, 2 decades later, we're heading to an interview we've already scheduled with him. Somewhere near the town of Gonzales, we look for a Waffle House shrouded in our personal hurricane lore. The Southern breakfast chain is well known for its smothered hash browns, but for storm riders, it has also long served as a gauge of a storm's severity. If the Waffle House is closed, then you've got real problems. But the particular restaurant we're looking for now was a refuge for Mel and me. We would sit, eat, and talk about the day and what we had seen. It was a simple and necessary slice of normalcy amid the destruction we were witnessing. It was the first time we covered a storm together, and we hardly knew then that we'd keep covering them for the next 2 decades. Everything looked different. Much of the recovery money that came from Washington was funneled into the suburbs along this drive. More malls and parking lots have cropped up. It's strange to see so much concrete in the bayou. When we finally find a Waffle House, we realize after sitting down that it's not the same one. In 2005, we had just covered events at New Orleans Convention Center, where masses of people milled in the middle of an airlift. Soldiers with M16s leaned lazily against lampposts as bedraggled women, men, and children, many just holding bags of their only belongings, lined up to be airlifted and flown to some other place with a functioning society. Houston, Atlanta, maybe Birmingham, Alabama. After reporting on the airlift, Mel and I left for Baton Rouge, where we retreated for a night. Then we headed to Camp Shelby on the off chance of snagging an interview with General Honoré, who is already becoming known to survivors as the savior of New Orleans. He had famously told New Orleans police to put those damn weapons down and instead focus their efforts on rescue and relief rather than on perceived threats. State and federal authorities were also bungling the initial recovery effort. It was slow and poorly coordinated, and officials could not make important decisions in a timely manner, even as existing emergency plans proved both inadequate and inefficient. When we arrived at the gate of Camp Shelby in Mississippi, we didn't know what to expect. An Army communications specialist said she'd see what she could do. She returned to say the general would see us in the morning. We were assigned bunks in the nearby barracks. The next morning, we met General Honoré, a native son of Louisiana, who was standing in the reddening dawn as helicopter blades cut through the air. He wore a tilted beret and a determined smile as he gathered staff and turned his attention towards the pair of reporters. As I asked him about the plans to secure the city, he started talking about the unique nature of the storm. Then, in a moment I'll always remember as a reporter, he suddenly grabbed my notebook and pen and started scribbling, drawing a battle map of Katrina's perfect attack. His hand-drawn map was rudimentary and messy, but it still stuns me. It's a snapshot of truth, a cultural memento in a reporter's notebook, and I've had it framed. We drive to a horse farm on the outskirts of Baton Rouge. General Honoré is sitting on a small porch. He greets us and later points out his chestnut sire, Old Red, in the paddock. The 6 weeks he spent in New Orleans after Katrina defined his career and much of his life afterward. What stays with him are, yes, the rows of body bags, but 80% of those who perished in Katrina, he says, were alone, old, homeless, or simply isolated from others. Then he once again grabs my notebook and starts scribbling another rough map, illustrating some of the same failures he saw during the recovery efforts in western North Carolina last year after Hurricane Helene. Helicopters sent to help failed to launch at critical moments. When it comes to disaster recovery, very little is working right, says General Honore. But one thing that is working is that we are learning to assign value to what culture means for storm recovery. It's become clear that the people who deserve the real credit for the recovery of New Orleans are the street people. Of the 11 communities hit by Katrina in Mississippi, the town of Waveland has been the slowest to recover. The small Gulf Front town was almost destroyed by Hurricane Camille in 1969. When Mel and I first went to Waveland after Katrina, we came upon an apocalyptic scene. Acres and acres of empty slabs where houses used to be. But on those slabs, people were already erecting tents. RVs pulled in, and from across the U.S., hundreds came to help, including church groups and other volunteers. It was strange, says Brian Fratter, a resident to return the day after the hurricane. If there is a tornado in Oklahoma, I don't think to run up there to help. But here came all these people, and they stayed for a long time. He and his wife, Beverly, found that their house, which they had just finished building the week before Katrina struck, was completely washed away. You stand there on the slab and you feel sorry for yourself and you want to cry about it, and you do. But then you look around and realize that everyone is experiencing the same thing. In some ways, much of Waveland had been a playground for the upper middle class and was full of second homes for wealthier New Orleans residents. Ornate Victorians, home-hewn furniture, and wooden boats helped define the lifestyle, as well as its tourist beaches and catfish joints. Ms. Frater remembers how a slab culture also grew up in a community after Hurricane Camille. Locals would visit and hang out where houses once stood, fish together, and congregate at the Catholic Church on Sundays. This time, not everyone has returned, she says. Since a lot of people had to deal with homes that were also damaged in New Orleans, it has taken a while. Some just couldn't do it. To streamline ongoing efforts, the Federal Emergency Management Agency no longer requires a clear title for people to qualify for rebuilding monies, just a document to show legal residency. New flood maps guide flood insurance policies. Thus, homes are perched in the trees, as Ms. Frater says. But the town lost much of its home values and thus its tax revenues. Despite organized state efforts to rebuild, Waveland continues to struggle, even though monuments and institutions, including the Ground Zero Hurricane Museum, mark the new Waveland. Yes, the old Victorians are gone and the new houses are mostly just boxes because it's so expensive to build, Ms. Fratter says. And the truth is, another Katrina would wipe us off the map again. But I still love it here. It's still a great community. I don't want to be anywhere else. My teen daughter recently joked, "Are you stalking Anders Osborne?" I usually prefer the truth, so I replied, "Maybe a little bit." I'm back home in Tybee Island, Georgia. I had really wanted to meet with Mr. Osborne when I was in New Orleans, an award-winning guitarist and songwriter whose oeuvre spans from Muddy Blues to Zydeco. He's a wily, magical powerhouse whose bouts with trauma and addiction found healing through music. His 17th and latest album, Picasso's Via, perhaps a stand-in for his own sun-splashed abode near Bayou St. John, hums less with regret than with reminiscence, how the darkness of his experiences in America resolves into light. As a familiar feeling stranger, he as well as his music holds a mirror to my experience. When my wife threw my old Gretsch guitar off our porch in anger, The one with the worn stickers from when our daughter was a toddler, it felt like a line out of an Osborne song. So did how I got its severed neck repaired, and then, intending a lighthearted joke, put it under the Christmas tree. After I opened that present to myself, it wasn't very funny, it turned out. Mr. Osborne's publicist had offered me a face-to-face interview 2 days after I set to leave, and when he calls me a week later, I get caught in a fanboy mode. Rambling on. Finally, he interrupts. Is there a question in there that I can answer? His life story is intricately entwined with New Orleans, and he vividly recounts his experiences. It was here, he explains, where he found camaraderie and foolishness, love and pain. But after Katrina, he found new purpose. It was at a scale that what you're looking at, it's not that it's flooding, it's everything that you stand on, says Mr. Osborne, a suggestion of Norse in his words. It's your past, high schools, grocery stores, post office, smiling neighbors, the street, colors, temperature, humidity, dialect, every nuance of the personality identity that you have created in this beautiful, illusionary life. Now all that has been taken away from you, from all of us, who no longer have any of that to stand on. It wasn't just despair. It was trauma, a complete elimination of who you thought you were. The question was not, where are we going to move? The question was, how am I going to go on now? He had the answer in his hand. His big Gibson J45 guitar had made it through the storm. Almost immediately, his guitar made some of the first celebratory noises in the city, part of a group of perhaps 2,000 musicians, artists, and various cultural accomplices. They gathered a small band every weekend at a joint on Magazine Street. National Guard members tapped toes along with survivors of the generator-fueled electric cords as the generator-fueled electric cords flew out the front door. Those sessions became the first flashes of resurgence, a glimpse of understanding and meaning that gave form to what would come. The music was where we all rallied, Mr. Osborne says. We needed it to just kind of have that as our central focal point where we could see each other, touch each other, cry together, laugh together. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for points of progress in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it and a paragraph or two or three or sometimes four describing that point. Number one, Colombia. Indigenous people are gaining self-governance, a move advocates say puts Colombia on the cutting edge for indigenous rights in Latin America. Colombia's new legal framework, which has been in the making since 2018, gives indigenous communities direct control over their land. It enables them to operate as local governments with public budgets and administrative power. In other Amazon nations, such as Brazil, indigenous groups are often only given land grants or rights of ownership. That often leaves communities to navigate overlapping jurisdictions, because indigenous groups' borders may stretch across multiple states or municipalities. Advocates say they hope the system agreed to in May will push other countries to follow suit, and celebrated it as a win for Amazonian forests crucial to combating climate change. That was from the Associated Press and Rainforest Foundation in Norway. Number two, United States. In Massachusetts, a cost-sharing program is keeping alive community solar projects that might otherwise fail due to the high expense. Solar developers typically pay for upgrades to the grid, which are necessary to connect to a new solar project. But now, a build-in-advance-pay-later structure means ratepayers are helping out via their future electricity bills. Representing customers' interests, the state's attorney general's office is one of the stakeholders who worked on the plan over 6 years, influence a shift of some of that cost back to developers. The plan will increase ratepayers' bills in the short term, said Kate Tome, of developer New Leaf Energy. However, once the grid is modernized and we get distributed energy interconnected, it's going to drastically decrease our electricity costs by bringing renewable energy and batteries online. And that was from Canary Media. Number three, Malta. Malta will provide free period products at all 58 middle and secondary schools following a pilot last year. The Mediterranean country aims to eliminate stigma, normalize discussions on menstrual health, and ensure inclusive access. As part of Malta's 2022 plan to promote gender equality, the 18% value-added tax for menstrual products will be eliminated. In the 2024 index by the European Institute of Gender Equality, Malta ranks 13th out of 27 countries. The nation's Equality Commission, in its comments on the index, noted improvement over several years in the division of labor at home. 78% of women and 63% of men reported doing daily cooking and housework. That was from Times of Malta and the National Commission for the Promotion of Equality. Number four, Senegal and Kenya. Women leaders' problem-solving helped make their businesses more resilient. In a small study of entrepreneurs in especially climate-vulnerable parts of Kenya and Senegal, women managers were more likely to enact decisions to safeguard a business instead of addressing short-term needs. For example, they would grow an additional or a different crop instead of shedding employees. According to the research, these strategies can reduce vulnerability to climate change and boost income stability. For governments and donors, investing in more women-led businesses could offer strategic means to address climate justice concerns, the authors wrote. Small and medium-sized businesses provide 80% of all job opportunities in sub-Saharan Africa and generate as much as 40% of some countries' gross domestic product. At 24%, African women have the highest rates of entrepreneurship in the world by some estimates. That was from The Conversation, MIT Sloan, and International Finance Corporation. And last but not least, South Korea. A city-run program is combating isolation among adults of all ages. Since 2021, Seoul support centers have sought to improve the quality of life for single-person households and offered counseling and classes such as pet care, cooking, and exercise. Residents can build connections through watching movies, volunteering, or dining out. About 152,000 people used the centers between 2022 and 2024. Some 39% of Seoul's 9.6 million residents live alone. As a proportion of people living alone has grown globally, researchers have recognized the benefits of supportive social networks. In a citywide survey of one-person households from April 2025, people ranked eating a balanced diet, dealing with household chores and health emergencies, and social isolation among the challenges. And that was from the Korea Herald and Seoul Single-Person Household Portal. And all that was compiled by Cameron Pooh and Troy Aiden Sambajan, who are staff writers. Okay, as I mentioned at the top of the show, science and nature is AWOL, so I'll read the explainer. And it's entitled, As Alligator Alcatraz Opens, Detention Centers Quietly Expand Across the U.S. This is written by Caitlin Babcock and Sarah Matusek, who are both staff writers. Oh, and they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. President Donald Trump is touting Florida's unusual new immigration detention facility in the Everglades, part of a wider effort underway to create spaces to hold people the administration aims to deport. President Donald Trump made a visit July 1st to mark the opening of a controversial immigrant detention site in Florida that officials have dubbed Alligator Alcatraz, underscoring the administration's commitment to expanding its mass deportation campaign through a variety of partnerships. This facility is exactly what I want every single governor in this country to consider doing with us, said Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem in Florida with the president. The alligator Alcatraz site is one in an array of unorthodox ways in which the Trump administration and supportive states are looking to square a rise in the number of immigrants arrested with limited space to hold people while they await court proceedings or deportation. The effort raises questions about how many new detention facilities are being built across the United States and what the long-term effort of such projects will be. The Trump administration has set an aggressive target of arresting 3,000 unauthorized immigrants a day, according to media reports, and the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, has declared a goal of 1 million deportations per year. As a result, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has needed to rapidly expand detention capabilities, including by increasing partnerships with state governments and private prison companies. Now, what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: what is alligator Alcatraz? Answer: Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer proposed the idea for the detention center in a June 19th video on the social platform X, nodding to the famous Alcatraz prison near San Francisco, now a museum. The Florida Detention Center is based at an old airport facility, and the site is bordered by the waters of the Everglades, which are home to alligators and pythons. Mr. Uthmeyer called the plan an efficient, low-cost opportunity to build a temporary detention facility and said he received approval for the plan from DHS. Florida is pursuing a hardline immigration enforcement campaign in support of President Trump's agenda. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis authorized the construction under emergency powers. The state quickly built up the site using heavy-duty tents and trailers. Secretary Noem said the site, which will be managed by the state of Florida, will have around 3,000 beds, with 2,000 at another location. In February, Governor DeSantis directed state law enforcement to enter into new agreements with ICE, allowing Florida officers to perform specific immigration functions like detaining individuals until ICE can take custody. Since the facility opened, detainees have complained of heat, poor plumbing, and lack of access to showers, according to multiple reports. Protesters lined streets outside a virtually abandoned airstrip in Florida on June 28th to oppose the official opening. Many cited environmental concerns and potentially poor conditions for the immigrants held there. The Miccosukee and Seminole tribes also consider the land sacred. Florida Representative Maxwell Frost, a Democrat, called the facility a cruel spectacle intended to brutalize, starve, and harm immigrants. Environmentalists have sued to stop the plan. Question: how is ICE expanding detention centers to meet deportation goals? Answer: Congress has currently allocated funding for over 40,000 detention beds, according to the American Immigration Council. The tax and spending bill Republicans in Congress scrambled to pass in early July allocates $45 billion for ICE to expand detention capacity for single adults and families. ICE has legal authority to detain people who are in removal proceedings or face removal orders. Detention requirements were expanded under the Laken Riley Act, passed earlier this year, requiring officers to detain individuals arrested for certain crimes, even if they're not yet convicted. Options for detention include partnering with state and local governments. ICE is also expanding no-bid contracts with private prison companies to free up more detention space. In places like Burlington, Massachusetts, a number of detainees have been held for days at a time in an ICE field office that's normally used for administrative work, according to local news reports. ICE did not respond to requests for clarification. Ira Melman, media director at the Conservative Federation for American Immigration Reform, supports the role of detention facilities. If you're going to have any meaningful way of actually executing deportation orders, then you have to keep people detained so you're sure that they can be removed, he says. Question: what are conditions like at these centers? Answer: The spike in ICE arrests has led to widespread complaints of overcrowding in detention centers, including allegations of unsanitary and sometimes unsafe conditions. In Burlington, lawyers told local media their clients lacked access to showers and sufficient food. DHS says that claims of overcrowding in ICE facilities are false and that ICE has higher quality standards for its facilities than most U.S. detention spaces. Conditions for detained immigrants have always been bad, says Eunice Cho, a senior staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union National Prison Project. But she says they have worsened under the second Trump administration. Immigrants are in civil detention. They are not serving time for criminal offenses, says Ms. Cho. Placing them in prisons is basically subjecting people to unconstitutional punishment. As of June 28, there were 57,861 individuals in ICE detention, the most since a previous high during the first Trump term, reports Austin Kocher, a researcher at Syracuse University. Just over half, 53% of those detainees had criminal convictions or pending criminal charges. The rest were immigration violators who did not have criminal convictions or charges known to ICE, according to the agency. Question: what kind of oversight do detention centers have? Answer: each ICE detention center is governed by internal standards that encompass food service, medical care, and the availability of legal materials. ICE conducts internal inspections of its detention facilities, which are usually pre-announced. The DHS Inspector General also conducts unannounced visits. Others who can conduct inspections include the Government Accountability Office and members of Congress. Congressional oversight was put in the spotlight in May when a confrontation broke out as a group of Democratic officials tried to inspect a recently reopened ICE detention center in Newark, New Jersey. Newark Mayor Raz Baraka was asked by federal officials to leave after he had entered through the gate. Federal agents then arrested him. The New Jersey U.S. Attorney's Office dropped the charges 10 days later. A federal grand jury subsequently indicted New Jersey Representative LaMonica McIver, who was also at the facility, on criminal charges for allegedly striking federal officials at the scene. Representative McIver has called the proceedings political intimidation. Legally, members of Congress are authorized to conduct oversight of any ICE facility used to detain migrants without providing prior notice of intent to enter. It's enormously important to be able to provide short-notice visits to facilities to be able to capture the actual human rights violations that are occurring, says Holly Cooper, co-director of the Immigration Law Clinic at the University of California, Davis School of Law. Because with notice comes cleanup, comes transferring of people. And the final question, how does ICE work with the private sector to detain migrants? And the final answer, as of January 2025, some 86% of ICE detainees were held in facilities run by for-profit entities. The two major players in private immigration detention are private prison companies, the GEO Group and Core Civic. Both have signed new detention facility contracts with ICE since Mr. Trump's inauguration, and stock prices for each soared in the days after Mr. Trump was elected. Government cooperation with private prisons companies isn't new. Tens of thousands of immigrants were held in private detention centers under both the Obama and Biden administrations, although both also pursued policies to phase out contracts with private prisons. And now for the Home Forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article and then a recipe follows. So here's the article. It was all Greek to me until it wasn't. In one magical midnight phyllo-making session, I learned that all I needed was love, and needed is spelled K-N-E-A-D-E-D. This is written by Caroline Lubbers. Two handfuls of flour, my sister-in-law translated as an older Greek woman deposited a heap of white powder onto the chicken or the kitchen table, a pinch of salt, about one thumb of olive oil, Dina, the Greek woman, explained, pointing to the middle of her thumb joint. I frantically scribbled the vague instructions in my notebook. For more than 20 years, my husband and I have made regular visits to my father-in-law's home in Corfu, an island off Greece's northwestern coast. As a red-headed Midwesterner, I've learned many lessons here, that reapplying sunscreen every 2 hours is important, that schedules in Greece are more like suggestions, and that meals with family last a minimum of 2 hours. Early in our relationship, my husband and I bonded over food, sealing our romance with an agreement to eat our way around the world together. While visiting his parents on Corfu each summer, we toured the island, dining at favorite tavernas, and hunting for new treats. One of our favorite bakeries in Corfu offers phyllo pies served hot out of the oven. Soft feta cheese, steaming spinach, or creamy custard fills layers of paper-thin, flaky pastry. A doorway into the kitchen offers a glimpse of the woman who expertly creates the pastry from scratch. Inspired by that woman, one summer I vowed to master the art of making phyllo. My father-in-law enlisted the help of an old friend. Dina grew up in Epirus, a region renowned for its rich tradition in phyllo making. Dina learned how to make phyllo from her grandmother. After Dina's mother passed away at a young age, she became responsible for feeding her many younger siblings. The evening that Dina was scheduled to visit, she arrived late, just as we were sitting down for dinner. I assumed that the phyllo lesson had been forgotten and tried to hide my disappointment. Around midnight, after hours of food, drink, and laughter, Dina asked to my surprise, "Doesn't the American want to learn how to make phyllo?" "Yes." The women followed her into the dimly lit kitchen and surrounded a small table. Dina produced a wooden dowel about half an inch in diameter, which my sister-in-law explained is the best tool for rolling out thin sheets of phyllo. With an ease earned from expertise, Dina mixed, kneaded, rolled, flipped, and explained how the dough should feel. She held the sheet of pastry to the light, declaring that when it is thin enough, you can read the newspaper through the dough. At the end of the lesson, Dina turned to me and held out her seasoned wooden dowel. A hush fell over the women as my sister-in-law explained that she was giving it to me. A few days later, when we arrived at the airport, I clutched my heirloom with plans to carry it on all three flights back to home to Chicago. A security worker quickly confiscated the wooden dowel and urged me through the metal detector. My father-in-law put up a good fight, gesticulating with a deep frown as I walked through security. When I turned back, he held the dowel up and with an apologetic shrug yelled, "He says he is sorry. He knows that these make the best phyllo pies." Back home, I continued to work on perfecting homemade phyllo. When I meet Greek women, I casually mention that I've made phyllo from scratch, which elicits a raised eyebrow and the tilt of a head, a small gesture of honor and approval. I even bought a wooden dowel from a craft store to roll the dough. It stands in the corner of the kitchen, a quiet reminder of the greater lessons inspired by that late night. In the years since, I've learned to knead dough and watch sauces with intuition, judging their readiness by look and consistency. I can smell when something is done and season without measuring tools. What has stayed with me most is not a recipe, but the feeling of cooking something meaningful. While I rarely make homemade phyllo anymore, that midnight lesson serves me daily as I taste my way through life. Okay, here is that recipe. Greek leek phyllo pie makes 8 to 12 servings. Here's what you need. 5 large leeks. 5 to 6 spring onions. 1/4 cup butter. 1/2 cup chicken or vegetable stock. 2 eggs. 1 for pie, 1 for brushing on top. 3/4 cup whole milk. 1 1/2 Greek feta cheese, or that's cups of Greek feta cheese, crumbled. 1 cup of Graviera or I'll spell this, G-R-U-Y-E-R-E, cheese, shredded. Salt and freshly ground pepper. 10 to 12 sheets, phyllo pastry, thawed. Olive oil for brushing the phyllo. And sesame seeds for topping, and that is optional. Now here's what you do with all this stuff. You got 10 steps. Number one, preheat the oven to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Number two, using only the white and light green stalks of the leeks, cut into 1/4-inch slices. Wash and dry thoroughly. Cut the white part of the spring onions into thin slices. Number three, heat the butter in a large pan. When it's melted, add the leeks and spring onions. Season liberally with salt and pepper. Sauté over medium-high heat until tender and soft. Add the stock to deglaze the pan and cook until it is evaporated. Remove from the heat and cool. Number four, in a separate bowl, combine one lightly beaten egg, milk, crumbled feta, and shredded Gruyere, or that cheese, G-R-U-Y-E-R-E, cheese. Stir the mixture into the cooled leeks and onions. Number five, prepare a 12 to 14 inch round pan or a rectangular lasagna dish by brushing olive oil on all sides. Place a sheet of thawed phyllo on the bottom. Brush with olive oil and layer another sheet on top, letting the excess phyllo hang over the sides. Continue until you have 5 layers. Number 6. Pour the filling on top of the layers of phyllo dough. Layer a piece of phyllo on top of the filling and gently press. Brush liberally with olive oil and continue to layer a total of 5 more sheets of phyllo on top. Roll the edges of phyllo down toward the pie to create a crust. Number 7. Combine 1 egg with 2 teaspoons of water and beat well. Brush the top of the pie with the egg wash. Number 8. Using a knife, score the phyllo into pieces. Sprinkle with sesame seeds if desired. Number 9. Bake in the preheated oven for about 45 to 50 minutes, or until phyllo is golden brown on top. And number 10, remove from oven and let stand for 5 to 10 minutes before serving. Well, we don't have time to read even one of the Monitor's Views articles, so I'll read from the Global Newsstand what this is. It gives you a newspaper name, where it's from, a headline, and a paragraph. Here we go. From the Taiwan News, from Taipei, Taiwan, Taiwan must be innovative to defend against China. Pressure builds across the Taiwan Strait, writes Guido Gargiulo, a contributing writer. Beijing continues to insist, loudly and systematically, that the country is part of its territory. Taipei is responding not with just rhetoric, but with innovation. The wars of today are not only fought with tanks and boots on the ground, they are fought with algorithms, data, and now drones. Drones are vital, especially for Taiwan. Taiwan needs to rapidly make itself too quickly, to take by force. With drones, Taiwan is investing not in just deterrence, but in unpredictability. There's another one from the U-Observer from Brussels. The EU is propping up a repressive regime in Serbia. Throughout months of popular protests against the Serbian regime, the European Union has stubbornly backed President Aleksandar Vučić, writes Kurt Busener and Toby Vogel, co-founders of Berlin-based think tank Democratization Policy Council. But now, Vučić's increasingly brutal repression of peaceful protests has put the EU's policy at an inflection point. Despite state violence, protests show no sign of easing. The EU's timid messaging has, in fact, encouraged Vučić to step up his repression. He unleashed violent thugs on the protesters and launched a relentless media campaign denouncing the students as terrorists. Let's be clear. The EU's choosing stability in the current moment means de facto endorsement of violent repression. And it looks like I won't have time to read any others here. But I wanted to say that all this was compiled by Hannah Goki and Tanya Raghu, who are staff writers. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.